Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today, Rob Sufer joins us. Now, many of you may know Rob. He is a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He was the former DASD in the first Trump administration, responsible for the Nuclear Posture Review and the nation's nuclear policy. So he's, and then I first met Rob whenever he was a PSM on the Hill. So Rob's had a long and storied career. He's a guy who knows a lot about nuclear policy and nuclear issues. Rob, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Adam, it's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Now, in the last couple of years, I would say you've really dug into missile defense issues and been an advocate for expanding the nation's missile defense capabilities. And of course, with the return of President Trump to the White House, he's recently announced his desire to build Iron Dome for America. So, you know, you're sort of on the right issue at the right time. So tell us a little bit about what in the research you've got a major report that's out and available at the Atlantic Council's website. Can you tell us a little bit about your research, what you found, and what you think the right course is for the nation?
Thank you, Adam. You know, we're actually pretty fortunate that Trump has announced his executive order for homeland missile defense. It makes our report so much more relevant. It's a report that we began probably 18 months ago, thanks to a grant from the Smith Richardson Foundation. And the title of the report is First, We Will Defend the Homeland, The Case for Homeland Missile Defense. Now, this title is chosen for a reason, because this phrase, first, we will defend the homeland, appears on the very first page of President Biden's national defense strategy. And in fact, it also appears in the Trump national defense strategy, and you can probably find it in the Obamas. The point is that defending the homeland against all threats, cyber, kinetic, space, missile defense, it's always the first objective. It's the prime objective, not only because the Constitution requires that the president provide for the common defense, but because defending the homeland really is the foundation of strategy. It's the foundation of U.S. grand strategy, I would argue. And this is the big idea I'd like to impart up front, and that is countries have noticed that as we continue to expand our capabilities to project power, right, and to reinforce our allies, they are also taking mind of the fact that we are vulnerable to their counterattacks. And so they are building capabilities to be able to threaten the U.S. homeland, whether it's rogue countries like North Korea and more traditional potential adversaries such as China and Russia, right? And the point here is that U.S. grand strategy relies on maintaining these favorable balances of power in key regions, right? And we rely on allies to maintain those balances. And the allies rely on us to provide security guarantees to them. As we become more vulnerable to missile strikes from adversaries in their regions, they start to question whether we would be willing to run risks on their behalf, right? This is the extended deterrence. This is the nuclear umbrella that we promise to them. This is why South Korea, for instance, and Japan are starting to wonder whether they need their own nuclear capabilities. It's not because North Korea can threaten South Korea with more nuclear weapons. It's because North Korea can threaten the United States. And the fear is that the U.S. vulnerability to North Korean nuclear threats and Russian and Chinese could coerce us, to get us to back down, to break our will, right? To put it in stark terms, former Army Secretary Christine Wormuth said back in February of 23, in a major war with China, the United States homeland would be at risk, with both kinetic and non-kinetic attacks. They are going to go after the will of the United States public. They're going to try to erode support for a conflict, right? And so again, my thesis is that if the increasing vulnerability of the United States to these missile attacks is making our allies nervous, then lessening that vulnerability, right, but through missile defenses, being able to shoot down ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, hypersonic glide vehicles, by lessening our vulnerability, we reassure allies and we add a deterrent effect to our potential adversaries. So the whole point of missile defense is not necessarily to provide an astrodome, impenetrable defense of the United States, right? But it's to complement our current deterrence policies that rely principally on the threat of retaliation with a missile defense, a deterrence by denial element. To put it again in simple terms, we want to convince adversaries that there is no scenario where they could use nuclear weapons against the United States and they would get us to back down. We want to convince them that any attacks on the United States would not only be futile because we would shoot down most of their missiles, but it would also be fatal because they could expect a retaliatory blow from us. So in a sense, this is the central idea of the paper. And we examine three important problem sets. The first one is the growing threat of North Korean ICBM attacks against the United States. And here, this is existing U.S. nuclear missile defense policy, which is to stay ahead of the North Korean threat. We all agree on that, Republicans, Democrats. It's been in the missile defense reviews over the past three administrations. So protecting against North Korean ICBMs is our policy, and we must continue to stay ahead of that threat. But it's becoming a little more challenging because North Korea is growing its ICBMs, and they're also developing multiple warheads for their ICBMs, and soon they will probably have more complex countermeasures or decoys on their ICBMs, right? And so our NORTHCOM commanders are saying, we are in an advantageous position now, but we may not be in the future. So we have to do things to stay ahead of the North Korean threat. And there are members of Congress that think that that's a bad idea. Why? Because as we continue to grow our missile defense capabilities, they're afraid that this would upset strategic stability with Russia and China and lead to an arms race. And we can explore that later, right? But the second problem set is the concern that Russia and China are building cruise missiles and ballistic missiles and hypersonic glide vehicles that can actually reach the United States. And we're concerned that not about an all-out massive nuclear attack, surprise attack, but again, these more limited strikes meant to stun us, right? But in a way that would get us to back down, stop fighting, but not so much that we would retaliate with nuclear weapons, right? The Strategic Posture Commission, the commission chartered by the U.S. Congress, called these limited coercive attacks against the United States, right? And they said that we need to build integrated air and missile defenses to defend not the entire homeland, but again, critical infrastructure, key areas, military targets, things that would need that we think the adversary would want to attack in a limited way. So that's the second problem set, right? This limited coercive attack by peer adversaries. The third is, and maybe this is the least likely. I'd be interested in your opinion on this. But the third is, look, we're faced with having to deter two major nuclear powers, right? Russia and China. And we're worried, perhaps, that the two countries, either sequentially or in a combined attack, could potentially disarm the United States in a first strike.
Right.
We call it a disarming preemptive first strike, right? And so if there is a growing vulnerability of U.S. nuclear forces, U.S. nuclear command and control to this combination of Russia and China, then perhaps deploying some preferential missile defense for our nuclear forces and our bomber bases, our submarine pens, and our nuclear command and control, if we can do that, we can complicate any notion of a disarming first strike. And that would contribute to deterrence, right? Because Russia and China would know that they wouldn't be able to completely disarm us in a first strike. So again, three problem sets where we think missile defense plays an important role. One is staying ahead of North Korea and potentially Iran in the future. The second is against these more limited Russian and Chinese coercive attacks, and they could be nuclear, or they could be non-nuclear, conventional attacks, right? And the third problem case is probably the worst case scenario, where Russia and China believe that they can get away with launching a disarming first strike and prohibit us from responding with a nuclear second strike. So those are the problem sets, and we make a policy strategy argument for why this is all important. But then in our report, we also try to address what the defense design would look like. What kind of defenses do we need to address this, right? And this is where the Trump's executive order comes in, because President Trump is asking for the Department of Defense to come back within 60 days with a specific architecture for how you would go about defending it. And I'll just say a couple of quick things about this. And again, the key objective of a missile defense system is not to defend the United States against every last attacking missile. That would cost too much, and quite frankly, it wouldn't be possible. So the objective is a more limited one. But the best way to achieve this is to have a layered missile defense system, right? Today, defending the United States is one layer. It's the ground-based mid-course defense system. We have 40 ground-based interceptors in Alaska and 4 in California, right? It's one layer. It's supported by sensors, ground-based sensors mostly. But the intention has always been to have a layered defense. If you go back and you look at the charter of the Missile Defense Agency, it is to deploy a layered missile defense. But we don't have that. But what we could do, actually, almost immediately, is we can add to the ground-based interceptor a couple of other layers. You know that we have this sea-based Aegis BMD system based on the Standard Missile 3, right? We have in the last year of the Trump administration, we actually conducted a test of the SM-32A off of a ship against a mock North Korean ICBM. So we proved the ability for this regional missile defense system, the SM-32A, to intercept a North Korean ICBM. So what we could do today, Adam, is we can build more of those. We can deploy them off ships. The ships could be based off the west coast of the United States, or you can actually deploy them on land, right, and free up the ships. In addition to the SM-32A, which intercepts missiles outside the atmosphere, we also have the Army's THAAD system. According to the industry that builds the THAAD, it has some capability against incoming warheads in the terminal phase. That is, after they re-enter the atmosphere, right? And that it doesn't have a large defensive footprint. It couldn't defend, you know, half the country, but it could defend, for instance, an ICBM silo field. Right?
Right.
Yeah. So you take these THAADs and you deploy them around ICBM fields or bomber bases, and now you have a multi-layered system, right? You've got the ground-based interceptor that can take a shot far away. Then it could probably take two shots. Then you've got the SM-32A that can take a shot when it's closer to the United States. And finally, when it comes back in the atmosphere, you can take a shot with the THAAD. We can do this probably within the next we could do this almost immediately. It's just a matter of integrating the system and buying more missiles. But this is a limited capability that, quite frankly, will not in the long run be able to address the more sophisticated Chinese and Russian threats, which is why you have to move to the next generation system. And this is the emphasis of Trump's executive order. It's to move to space, right? And you want to have space sensors so you can track and discriminate the threat from the false objects, but then also you want to have interceptors in space to shoot down the missile when it's in its boost phase or even in its mid-course phase. A lot of controversy over space-based interceptors. We can talk about that. It's sort of the third rail of missile defense politics, questions of weaponizing space and the like. But let me stop there because that's a mouthful. But the bottom line here is that we have to stop relying only on nuclear deterrence to support our grand strategy. Some measure of missile defense would reassure our allies and deter our adversaries. And in fact, this is recognized even by the Biden administration. Here's a quote from the 2022 Missile Defense Review. It says, "Missile defense systems, such as the ground-based mid-course defense system, offer a visible measure of protection for the U.S. population while reassuring allies and partners that the United States will not be coerced by threats to the homeland from states like North Korea and potentially Iran. The only problem with the statement is it doesn't include Russia and China, right? And yeah. I think where Trump is going is now he wants to build missile defenses not only against the rogues, but also against the near peers and the peers.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for that. That's a good explanation of sort of what you're advocating for. Now, unfortunately, it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, my question is, you know, and this is probably a question a lot of people have, and that's sort of how robust do you want it? Do you want it to be able to shoot down onesies and twosies? Do you want it to be able to shoot down, you know, an attack on the U.S. ICBM field? Give us a better sense of, you know, sort of how robust you want this system. So you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLAW Deterrent Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Rob Sufer. So I posed a question before the break. So, Rob, how robust is your desired capability?
Yeah, Adam, that's a good question. That's going to drive your architecture. It's going to drive how much you need to spend to achieve your objectives. And let me suggest that there may be three different criteria based on three different problem sets that I mentioned, right? So against a North Korean threat, we really want to defend all the United States. We want to be able to defend the homeland, cities, military forces, everything, right? And so that requires a missile defense system that has massive coverage of the entire United States, which the ground-based interceptor does have today. It's just that we don't have that many of them, right? Just 44. So against this threat, I'm gonna again, and these numbers are notional. The intelligence community should weigh in on this as the administration puts together its plans. But today, at the unclassified level, in the press, in the academic literature, we know that, or we think that North Korea has about 11 ICBMs. You will not find a U.S. government unclassified source for the number of North Korean ICBMs today or in the future. It's very classified for various reasons, right? But so I assume let's go with a few dozen, so maybe 36, right? Mm-hmm. And so let's size our capability against those 36. A lot of this is going to depend on your shot doctrine, right? If you have a two-on-one, if you're ground-based interceptor or your SM-3-2As are good enough that you fire two interceptors against one North Korean ICBM, then you need 72, right? I mean, it's just math. You have to, but what we're doing is by having a layered defense, you have really complicated the North Korean task. The North Koreans have to think now, Adam, how many will get through the ground-based interceptor? How many will get through the SM-3-2A? And how many will get through that? I mean, that is an impossible task. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but let me also say that we're not just going to sit back and wait for these missiles to hit. Part of our missile defense strategy is to go after the missiles before they're launched, right? And so some number of North Korean ICBMs hopefully will be eliminated on the ground. And so it's a combination of left of launch or attack operations and missile defense that provides that defensive protection. So again, with respect to North Korea, we're aiming for a few dozen warheads, which again, I think can be done through the existing systems. Now, with respect to the second problem set, limited Russian coercive attacks, you know, maybe this could be up to 10 ballistic missile warheads. It could be maybe 100 cruise missile strikes. It could be a smaller number of hypersonic glide weapons. But it's sort of in that limited range. And so now you need to put together an architecture that can blunt that kind of an attack. And it's a combination of the ground-based interceptor. It's a combination of cruise missile defenses, which we haven't really spoken about. Of course, NORTHCOM is a big advocate of defending the country against these cruise missiles that can be launched from sea or by aircraft. But again, we're talking about a limited number, 10 ballistic missiles, you know, maybe 100 cruise missiles. Again, these are limited strikes meant to bloody the United States, to break our will, but not so large that the United States would respond with nuclear weapons. Now, the
third do you think that for these limited strikes, and this is perhaps where, you know, I think through it, I would submit that the Russians and the Chinese, because of a fear, I'm not sure any president who accepts even, you know, 3, 4, 5, 7, 10 nuclear strikes against the United States could survive without a nuclear retaliation. So I would think, and this is just sort of me reading how I think people act, that the biggest threat from the Russians and the Chinese would be the theater use, maybe against Guam, maybe against, you know, Diego Garcia, you know, against some theater target. And so defending against those theater strikes would be really important. Do you see the bigger threat against, you know, a small, you know, let's say take out Barksdale Air Force Base? Or do you see, you know, how are you thinking that the Russians or the Chinese would attack U.S. targets with nuclear weapons?
Yeah, so, I mean, you're absolutely right. Any conflict, especially a limited nuclear war, would start in the regions.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. But the question is, would it then escalate to attacks against the homeland? So, for instance, China, according to the latest unclassified OSD report to Congress, they are building a conventionally armed ICBM. That's not for regional use, Adam, right? That's to attack.
For sure, for sure.
And so we have to scratch our heads and ask us, well, why are they doing that? Are they intending to attack us? Probably so. And so we're just trying to eliminate that threat. Again, you're absolutely right. We have to continue with the theater missile defense capabilities, but we have been out of balance in the sense that we have favored, especially during at the end of the Cold War, we have favored regional missile defenses over homeland missile defenses. And there was probably good justification, right? Because we had the Scuds in the Gulf War, and these weapons are certainly more mature than the intercontinental range systems from countries like North Korea. But the emphasis of this particular report, and I think of the executive order from Trump, is, hey, it's time now to first defend the homeland.
Well, let me ask you, this is sort of, I don't disagree with you. I think we definitely need more missile defense. But for me, the bigger challenge, sort of, if you want to, you know, talk about root causes or root challenges, you know, as I, you know, do the analysis, our fundamental problem is an economic one, in the sense that if you look at, you know, I've been in some debates with some, you know, with some of my progressive friends who have argued that we need to spend more money on social programs. And so I just went and looked at federal spending, and I looked at, you know, state and local spending. And about 65% of the federal government spending, which was, you know, the federal government in 2024 took in $4.4 trillion, but it spent $4.6 trillion on what you might call either transfer programs, entitlement programs. So it's already spending more than 100% of what it takes in. And you really can't increase taxes to the point that, because, you know, the higher taxes, this is the Laffer curve, the higher taxes go, the lower GDP goes. And so, and then if you look at state and local spending, they also spend about 2/3 of all their spending on entitlements, transfers, things of that nature. So the biggest problem is, we talk about nuclear modernization, about rebuilding the military, about missile defense. All of these things are in competition with domestic entitlement spending that already consumes every dollar the government takes in. And so I wonder how, you know, your argument is a legitimate one, and the need for nuclear modernization, for offensive systems, is a legitimate one, and the need to build a bigger Navy, if we want to deter or defeat China, that's a legitimate one. But my bigger question is sort of, how are we going to do this at a time when defense spending has been in a steep decline, And, you know, it's now like 3.3% of GDP. It's at an all-time low. And it's being crowded out by these entitlement programs. And I don't hear the defense folks. They talk about the things we need, but they never talk about the things we're going to have to stop doing in order to build them. So have you thought through sort of this second part of any argument that I, as a, you know, as a nuclear modernization advocate, which, you know, you as well, and as an advocate for missile defenses, how are we going to go after this fundamental problem that there are things we're going to have to stop doing in order to build these capabilities we want?
Adam, I think at the risk of you know, you and I are our job in this particular case is to advocate for the nuclear portfolio and the missile defense portfolio. There are people above us who make the grand trades, and we understand that. We're professionals. We understand that. We make our best case and we move forward. But let me just add two things related more to this topic. First of all, I noticed that the Republicans in Congress are looking for a budget agreement that would add $150 billion to the Department of Defense. That's what they're toying with right now. You know, if that happens, then this frees up money for missile defense. I don't know if it will, but this is where their heads are. And I know there's a battle between the budget hawks and the deficit hawks and all that. But more to our point here is, look, we spend a third of 1% of the defense budget on the Homeland Missile Defense Mission. Let me say that again. A third of 1%, right? So MDA's budget is $10 billion. They spend about $3 billion on GMD and the Homeland Missile Defense. That's a third of 1%. Adam, just give me 1%. 1% of the defense budget for the number one mission of the Department of Defense, which is to defend the homeland. Just give me 1%. And that would add another, say, $4 to $5 billion for missile defense, and we can go a long way to solving this problem. That's my pitch.
Yeah, that's okay. So now I'm looking at the clock, and we're getting low on time. But I don't want to end the show without bringing Bob the Genie out. And as I rub my magic lamp, Bob grants you Rob 3 wishes, and so you know you get your 3 wishes in regard to our conversation about missile defense. So, Rob, let me ask you, what is your first wish?
Well, my first wish is, and it may be Pollyannish, but I'm hoping that we can find a compromise on the consensus between Republicans and Democrats over homeland missile defense policy, right? The current consensus is, yeah, we will build defenses against rogues like North Korea, okay? I'm hoping that we can move that meter just a little bit to address threats from Russia and China. And I think we're moving in that direction because, again, the Bipartisan Strategic Posture Commission, you know, chartered by Congress, had made that recommendation that now we need to start thinking about defending against Russia and China. So let's move the meter. That's one wish, right? My second wish is that when the Department of Defense gets back to the president on the way ahead, that it is sort of a phased approach, and that we take advantage of what we can do in the near term, which is, you know, adding more SM-3 2As and THAAD missiles to build out this truly layered defense system, and that we do not abandon what we can do today in order to search for the next generation system. But my third request is again that we do apply sufficient research and development funding to get at the space-based interceptor, the lasers, the particle beams, the things that will truly change the cost curve of missile defense in the future, because I don't think our potential adversaries are going to stop spending money on offensive missile threats. So, Adam, with that, I'll conclude.
Yeah, so it's a good – this is one of the questions I didn't get a chance to ask, but and that is the space-based component. Besides sensing, when it comes to actual, you know, defensive capabilities, do you envision, you know, missiles in space? Do you envision lasers in space? Is this, you know, SDI matured? How do you envision that defensive space-based capability looking?
Right. So there are two ways to go, at least two ways to go that I think are being considered. Again, and we have to see where the administration lands on this. But look, you can build space-based interceptors. These are essentially, you know, satellites, mini satellites that are circle around the globe. They see the incoming warhead and they just home in on it and explode by making contact. This was very expensive to do in the past, but think Elon Musk, think Starlink. They put up, you know, 5,000 satellites a year. Or some large number like that. They have brought down the cost of launching things into space and building things that go on satellites. So if you can do this, if you can populate the globe with, I don't know, maybe it's 1,500, 2,000 of these mini satellites, you can have a space-based defensive capability. Also, I understand that we are working on high-powered microwaves and other things that can provide effects against warheads, not by bashing into them, but by other yeah. measures, but also in space.
Okay. All right. Well, this is, so as we sort of wrap up, if you have your elevator speech that you want our listeners to sort of walk away and remember 6 months from now, what is that key idea or concept that you think everyone has to keep in mind with missile defense?
Right. Well, the first key idea is that adversaries, whether they're rogues or near peers or peers, they are building missiles to be able to coerce us, to keep us from defending our allies and defending our vital interests abroad. As a result, our allies are getting very nervous. They're wondering if the United States will continue to provide that nuclear umbrella to them. And they're concerned that the United States, the increasing vulnerability to the United States by countries like North Korea may deter us or coerce us from coming to their support. The bottom line here is if we can reduce our vulnerability to threats, this enables U.S. grand strategy, enables us to convince our allies that we are going to be a good ally. We are willing to run risks on their behalf. That strengthens the alliance and that deters adversaries. That's the key strategy argument. But the missile defense argument is we cannot rely only on a single missile defense system to protect the homeland, which is today's ground-based mid-course defense system. We must build a layered system so that the adversary now is faced with having to penetrate not only one layer, but maybe two or three layers, making the attacker's problem exponentially more difficult, and thereby, again, creating uncertainty in their mind, which instills hesitation and doubt, which at the end of the day, I think, contributes to deterrence of attacks.
All right. Rob Super, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Thank you, Adam. Take care.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Well, it's always great to talk to Rob. You know, he does good work, and he's you know, for the probably 15 years I've known him, he's been a real considered thinker. And so it's good to see him working on this issue and advocating for missile defenses, because he makes a very good point. You know, if you look at the Constitution, one of the powers granted to the government and to the president is to defend the nation. And so, you know, this is the modern threats we face. So missile defense is, you know, it's a reasonable thing to want to develop to defend the country.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.